Vous écoutez l'autre monde? Nous sommes aux Utopiales, and we are with Steven Erikson. Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you. Thank you.
It's not your first time in France, of course, but first time in Nantes?
Yes, it's my first time.
To be in the city of Jules Verne, what do you feel about that? Does it ring a bell about maybe readings when you were younger?
Yes, I read all of Jules Verne, in fact. H.G. Wells and Jules Verne were my two sort of earliest science fiction authors. And it's been great to be here. It's a beautiful city. I was in the cathedral a few days ago. It's simply gorgeous.
To talk about your French audience, do you feel something special about the French people? Do they read your book as everywhere around the world? Or is there something really French-Dutch?
That's an interesting question. I know this is the second try, if not the third try, for this series, The Malaise and Book of the Fallen. But I've been delighted since I've been back. It's been, I feel very much in touch with this culture. I appreciate it, despite the fact that I can't speak French. When I'm in with the groups in the panels and interviews and all the rest, I just feel comfortable here, very comfortable.
Third time for the translation in France. Mm-hmm. Are you cool with that? Or how do you work with the editor?
Well, the editors are standing right behind me, or right behind you. But it's been great. And what I've really been delighted with is the fact that this has been planned well in advance. Mm-hmm. So that we have, because the 10-book series is done, I think there are already 5 translations. Mm-hmm. So the books will be coming out every 6 months, and I think that establishes a momentum for the readers, that they don't have to wait. Because I think what has happened in fantasy of late is there are many fantasy authors, very popular ones, who start a series but have yet to complete them. And so the fan base ends up having to wait a long time, and they get impatient, and for good reason. So in this case, all of them are going to be coming out on a six-month basis, and so the readers will always have something new.
Have you got an eye on the French book for the cover, maybe? Or?
Oh, they're beautiful covers. Yeah, they're very nice, and they're original covers as well. Quite often what happens with translations is, I remember seeing a number of books by Glenn Cook, for example, mm-hmm. in the United States, printed by Nightshade Books, and beautiful covers. And then I would see one of those covers on one of my books somewhere in Eastern Europe. That cover would show up again. So it was quite common to see covers sort of make their way across from different authors. So to see these ones as original ones is really nice. In fact, I'm hoping to eventually get good signed copies of all 10 covers from the artist.
And do you work with him? Or do you let him free? Or is it the job of the editor to choose the cover?
I think it's the job of the publisher, yeah. The only instance where I've had any input, well, I do get some inputs. Usually the editor will write to me and say, do you have a scene in mind that might be good for the cover? And I'll give 2 or 3 options, and usually they pick the fourth one. So, yeah. But that's okay. Whatever the cover comes out as is... It's generally not in the hands of the author.
We know you as a writer, but you are also an archaeologist.
I was.
You was? You?
I volunteer.
Yeah.
I volunteer still, but I'm no longer professionally an archaeologist.
Imagine that maybe in 5,000 years from now, an archaeologist found your book.
Oh, dear.
Could he maybe think that it could be a testimony?
Yes, well, the series is written as if it were a history, and it's from multiple points of view to give shape to that history, so that it's not a single sort of thematic thread that runs through it. So it explores the human condition. And so in that sense, as a fantasy novel, especially, it's timeless. So it should be as impactful in 5,000 years, one hopes, as it is now.
You first imagine the world, this world, for role-playing.
Mm-hmm.
And do you put in the book only characters that you created yourself, or did you put some players too?
There are players, yes. In fact, a number of the books, the dedications, are to those players.
Okay.
But I would say in probably about 10% are played characters. Maybe not even that. So it's a small number, but they had crucial roles when we were role-playing the game. So I wanted to honor that and honor their participation.
You said that maybe there will be a real game of the theory.
Yes.
Is it for soon now?
There's a team in either Oregon or Washington who are working on a game system based on our stuff. But it's early days yet.
And do you let them free to create their game, or have you got something in your mind too, and do you speak with them?
Actually, the Malazan world is co-created. It's myself and Ian C. Eslamont. And I got so busy that I handed everything over to Ian. And we'll see what he can do. But generally, I think what they're working on now is a 20D system. And it's based on, I think, something they've created themselves. So there's a lot of preliminary things that have to be done to sort of lay out the framework of how to play the game. And at some point, they will be contacting us for all the details. So maps, notes, that kind of thing.
There is the story of the 10 books, of course, but there is more than the adventures. There is the community, there is politics, there is magic, there is God who can be there for real and act in the human world. How do you work this so huge world? I mean, we know that it was role-playing, so you've got this in mind for 10 years or something like that. But how did you focus on every single part of this huge stuff? Did it come step by step, or have you got already the whole universe in mind at the first time?
I think it built up organically, like as you described, through our gaming. And we slowly added maps and added cultures. Both myself and Cam, Ian Eslamont, are anthropologists first. And so we wanted that kind of anthropological approach to creating this world. At the same time, we've got something based on kind of the Iliad, so Homeric, so that gods are active, there is magic in the world, and that has an effect on civilization and culture. And one of the things we looked at was creating a magic system whereby magic is accessible to everyone. And because of that, you cannot make your power base in politically exclusive. So it cannot be gender-based. And so it's a world without sexism. And that really drove what we were trying to do in our series.
I find this part interesting nowadays because the book was written a long time ago, if I can say so.
Yeah,
and now what we are living today for Me Too and stuff like that, and it's ring a bell really nowadays. Is it just like that, or do you think that maybe at this time you already got something in mind and you were already in the future?
You mean were we prescient? Maybe. The thing that I think we were reacting against was in generic epic fantasy, patriarchy is almost lazily transferred across into a fantasy world. And we found that somewhat frustrating because if you do that, it assumes that patriarchy is a natural law that must exist in a medieval society or must exist in a fantasy setting. And there's no natural law that says that at all. And so we wanted to really make a point that if you create a world with magic that's accessible to anyone, you cannot have those artificial hierarchies imposed because they can be broken apart effortlessly. And so we wanted that to be a kind of an undercurrent running through our fantasy world. That it's fantasy is the genre that takes a metaphor and makes it real. So we took the metaphor of basically a colorblind, non-sexist world and then made it as real as we could.
Is it also the reason why the god can be in real life and there is a special relationship between the worshipper and the god?
Yeah, we figured that if a god can actually be physically present, then they are as vulnerable as the mortal worshipper. And so there has to be an agreement between the two. In other words, you would worship on the basis of recognition of some kind of reward, and it would be a real reward as opposed to an imagined one. And so in that sense, we are talking also about the relationship between mortal humans, or mortal anyone, and their god or gods. And so there's a lot about religion is kind of another undercurrent running through this.
We only have two books in mm-hmm. French now. There is so much step in the book. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's something like an onion or something that?
It is.
Some people have described my writing style, probably Eslamon's as well, as archaeological, which means you excavate through the text to get to the truth. So I think that's a pretty good description, actually.
And yourself, you're not now at the end of the excavation because you're still working on for a new book 10 years after the Malaysian stories. Yeah. It will be out in English first, of course. Mm-hmm. Have you got a schedule already?
I think I'm delivering the manuscript in the spring.
Okay.
So April or May. And then it usually takes about a year before it comes out.
Did you ever thought to a soundtrack to listen when we read your book?
I used to write to music all the time, but I would not write to instrumental. I would need lyrics, and I needed good lyrics. So I became a huge fan of Bruce Coburn, a Canadian performer, also a very good poet. So writing like Pink Floyd, Roger Waters for sure. Let's see, who else? Leonard Cohen. You know, basically great language and beautifully presented. Always inspired me as a writer. So that would be in my headphones as I wrote. These days, I don't do that as much, but it was a very useful means of almost subconsciously falling into rhythms and patterns.
This year, the theme of the utopial are the body. What do you think when you hear that word body?
What do I think when you hear the word body? I think the body is the necessary limitations to our consciousness. And I know there's been some interesting conversations on panels, things here, where they're talking about almost the post-body extension of the consciousness into computers or some other mechanical means. That actually worries me, because I think we need our limitations. We need our physical limitations. And without them, the potential of the mind is in a sense, almost limitless, and that makes it somewhat frightening.
Are you scared, like, I may say, Stephen Hawking, about AI or stuff like that?
Artificial intelligence? Yeah. I don't believe it is actually possible, or it will not occur the way many people are predicting. I don't think you can simply continually add mechanisms of cognition or reams of memory, chip after chip after chip, and then suddenly reach a certain point where this becomes a self-aware entity. I don't think that's possible. But that's just my opinion. So a lot of people disagree with that, and they're looking to achieve something along those lines. But my personal belief is consciousness is something that actually exists in a liminal state. In terms of our brains and our bodies, you cannot find it in there. It's the equivalent of looking for the little band playing inside the radio. It's not there. We are just the receivers, and we transmit our consciousness outwards. And when the radio breaks down, when the body finally breaks down, that consciousness moves on. And that's why I don't think AI is possible.
To end our interview, every year we've got a special question. Mm-hmm. This year I will give you 5 items, and you can pick one between these 5. You can choose between Clark Kent glasses, the Little Red Riding Hood little basket, the Marty McFly's shoes, Sherlock Holmes' violin, or Indiana Jones' hat. Which one would you pick?
I would pick Indiana Jones' hat, obviously, as an archaeologist. I actually have known archaeologists to wear that kind of fedora. One of them, Scotty McNeish, there's a classic picture of him on a project that I worked on in Belize, in Central America. And he's standing beside a stream. He's got a hat just like that one. And he's got a Colt 45 tucked into his belt.
Oh.
A pistol for shooting snakes, apparently. But it's a great shot, so I'd pick the hat.
A last word you would like to say to your French listeners, because you are at the beginning of a French tour?
Stay with the series, invest in the series, and as grim as some of it may turn out to be, book by book, in terms of tragedy and loss, there will be a payoff in the end, I promise.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.